All right, once again, right on the dime. Unfortunately, the dime was in Rocky Rococo's pocket. That's right, that's where my head is these days, back at the Firesign Theater. So anybody recognize that? Meet me somewhere. We'll have a pickle for a nickel, a pickle in a bag. Anyway, okay, all right, enough of that. We have a great show for you today. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with J.C. Montgomery. J.C. is one of the lead actors in the Scottsboro Boys play, the musical, and it's a people have heard me talk about it. It's a great play. We'll be talking with J.C. all about that. Opening the show up, we're going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Syria. All right. On June 13th, the Obama administration announced that it was escalating U.S. military involvement in the war in Syria by openly and directly supplying the Syrian opposition with weapons and military equipment for the first time, and by positioning more U.S. military forces in neighboring Jordan. This is an incredibly important situation to pay attention to right now. It's a horrific civil war has now become a focus of international intrigue and maneuvering among the imperialist countries and others in the region with unforeseeable and possibly explosive consequences. And joining us to talk about all this is Larry Everest. Larry is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda, and a frequent guest on the show. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to talk with you today.
You too, man. Well, let's jump into this. As I said in my introduction, you know, this is something that is just, it's an incredibly important development in the world, and it's something that has this escalation, this Obama's announced escalation, it just brings things to a whole other level. I want to ask you, let's start with this. What are they talking about in terms of escalating the military involvement?
Well, it's not fully clear, actually. So far, what they've been talking about is fairly light weaponry. Light mortars, automatic weapons, and so on. But there's probably much more to that than meets the eye. There's been talk of CIA training camps and direct CIA training and involvement. And part of the issue here is if the United States is committing itself, and it's not clear precisely what they intend this military equipment to do. In other words, they may be trying to position themselves better at a bargaining table rather than thinking they can intervene on the level that would directly lead to the defeat of the Assad regime. But there's the real danger that by declaring publicly Assad must go, and committing themselves to directly supporting the so-called rebels, which are really a combination of pro-U.S. wannabe clients and reactionary Islamists and jihadists, none of which would be any good for the people of Syria. The danger is that if this small infusion of weaponry doesn't really do the job, more would be coming, and the Free Syrian Army is already demanding shoulder-fired missiles, and by the way, these are people that have threatened to shoot down civilian aircraft. This is who we're talking about. Shoulder-fired missiles, a no-fly zone, anti-tank weapons, much heavier weaponry, which, of course, would escalate the conflict and increase the chances that it would spread across the region. The other dimension, and you mentioned this in terms of the U.S. positioning of military equipment in Jordan, this is another dimension of it, because the more ominous or potentially ominous developments could be larger U.S. and or Israeli attacks, either on Syria, and we've seen several Israeli limited bombing attacks on Syria, but this could also draw in or become linked to the U.S. threats against Iran over its nuclear program, but actually over its geopolitical reach, which is very much concentrated in what's going on in Syria.
All right. Well, we're going to get into a lot of that in the very, very soon, actually. But I also want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the recent announcement by the Obama administration that they are going to escalate their military intervention in Syria. Larry, one of the things, you know, this point about escalation, you have argued that actually, okay, there's an escalation because actually there has been, this intervention in Syria has been going on since the uprisings against the Assad regime began. Explain that.
Well, the uprising against the Assad regime, which is a reactionary, repressive, and pro-imperialist regime, even though it has had contradictions with the United States, it has also been a place the United States rendered suspects, terror suspects, quote unquote, to be tortured. While there's certainly tension between Israel and the Assad regime in Syria, Assad has actually helped maintain Israel's strategic security and its borders. And Assad was also part of the 1990-1991 invasion of Iraq by the United States, and other imperialist countries supported that. So this uprising against Assad began in March 2011. It was linked to the whole Arab Spring. The people have very righteous complaints and discontent. The shame of it is, has been there's no leadership, revolutionary and genuine leadership that is actually expressing the interests of all the Syrian people. But and initially the U.S., because Syria has been helpful, didn't call for Assad's ouster. After about 6 months, it did begin to call for Assad's ouster. And U.S. allies like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar also began supplying the opposition with various levels of military aid. And of course, since August or September or so of 2011, there's been a steady drumbeat of propaganda from the U.S. imperialists that Assad's a butcher, that they are looking out for the interests of the Syrian people. They don't want to see a repressive regime continue, and so on, which is not only hypocritical, but when you're They've organized a lot of international diplomatic political support for these reactionary rebels that they are supporting. And this is all of this has had the impact of prolonging and escalating the conflict, because when the U.S. makes a statement, we support such and such a rebel, It emboldens people to continue to fight and think that at some point the U.S. is going to come in and intervene. And the net result of this has been that there's the estimates are 93,000 Syrians killed, 1 million Syrians driven out of Syria, 4 million are in internal exile in Syria. It's just a horrific nightmare, and various international agencies have documented human rights abuses and war crimes on both sides. And I think people have, you know, certainly the Assad government has ruthlessly shelled cities and reduced them to rubble in certain places. Meanwhile, we're looking at videos of one of the rebel commanders eating the heart out of one of the regime's soldiers. So there's no good side in this, and what the U.S. has done is really prolonged and escalated. And now pouring further arms in has absolutely nothing to do with resolving the horrific humanitarian crisis, which is not confined to Syria, by the way. Iraqi refugees who were forced into Syria as a result of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the subsequent sectarian war fueled by the United States have found such a horrific situation in Syria. Now they're forced to come back into Iraq, and another nightmare. Lebanon is being greatly impacted by this. There are Syrian refugees who fled to Jordan, and the conditions in the camps in this U.S. ally, by the way, a so-called enlightened regime, were so horrific that these refugees are coming back into Syria even as they know they're risking death. So,
let me ask you this, Larry. Let me ask you this, because I think it's important, everything you're saying. I also want to get into, though, this whole question. Look, part of the thing is, when you're talking about all this that's going on in that region, You also mentioned, and you have an article, I should let people know, we're talking with Larry Everest, and he's the author of a recent article that you can get at revcom.us. And the article is U.S. Military Escalation in Syria, Yet More Horrors in Store for the Syrian People. Now, Larry, one of the things that has come up in relation to all this, and in your writing in particular, that you talk about how the U.S. has actually been going for a controlled demolition of the Assad regime. And like we're looking at this, and it seems like, I mean, one, there's a question of what does that mean? And then two, is that really something that, how does that fit into this whole thing that you're describing?
Let's just step back for a minute. Everything the U.S. is doing now in Syria, everything it has been doing since September 11, 2001, everything, in fact, it's been doing for the last six decades, and we can go back to the turn of the century, has been about imperialism. In other words, it's been to further U.S. control, domination, exploitation of this critical region of the world. This is where 60% of the world's energy resources are. You know, which is a key part of the entire global economy. There's a lot of talk now, well, now the U.S. is energy self-sufficient, so it won't need the Middle East. No. To whatever degree the U.S. is energy sufficient, self-sufficient or not, control of the Middle East is a key pillar of controlling the global economy and controlling the countries who depend on oil. And, of course, this is what I've documented in my book, Oil, Power, and Empire. And it's also a key military, geographic, strategic crossroads. So what the U.S. has been doing is to ensure and deepen and fend off challenges to its dominance in this region. And this has been especially acute. This is why the entire war on terror was launched in 2011. It wasn't about defeating terror. It was about strengthening the U.S. grip on this region for the reasons I've outlined. And what's happened is that the main obstacle, the U.S. confronts many obstacles in the region, including other imperialist or rising powers, Russia, China, other countries who are seeking inroads and influence in this region. But the key thing, really, the U.S. has been confronted is what Bob Avakian has called the clash of two outmoded reactionary forces, mainly imperialism and the U.S. on one side, but confronted by Islamic fundamentalism or different political trends that seek to impose their version of Islam on the societies of these regions. And this comes in direct conflict with the U.S. agenda in the area. And this is very sharp. We see this in the fight between the U.S. and the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it's especially acute with the U.S. and Israeli confrontation with Iran, with the state of Iran, over preventing any real challenges or inroads to U.S. hegemony in the region, which is what's represented in Iran. It's not mainly about a nuclear weapon. The nuclear weapons issue is a subsidiary of the regional hegemony issue. But coming to Syria, and I think it's important for people to look at this larger background, coming to Syria, the U.S. saw this uprising as a chance to weaken a regime in Bashar al-Assad's regime that had been a problem for them, but mainly to weaken the state of Iran, because right now the state of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the state of Syria, and the Hezbollah organization in Lebanon are three of the forces that are really, they're not in full opposition to imperialism in the region, but they have interests and they want to assert a certain degree of power that conflicts with what the U.S. and Israel find themselves compelled to do to maintain their complete control and domination of the region. So taking down Assad would be a major blow against Iran and a major blow against this alliance of forces that are in conflict with Israel and the U.S. And that's really what's driving this.
Okay, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Larry Everest. He's the author of U.S. Military Escalation in Syria, Yet More Horrors in Store for the Syrian People, which you can find on revcom.us, which is the site for Revolution Newspaper, which Larry Everest writes for. Larry, you know, okay, so this is very heavy in terms of what you're laying out, because you don't get this kind of analysis anywhere else in terms of, you know, what are all the various forces and how do they fit into imperialist interests? And I was going to ask you before about what the imperialist interests are, you know, because we always talk about, well, it's because of imperialist interests, and we never say what they are, and you actually did a good job of digging into that. However, I also want to ask you this. Because we've been talking about this thing about controlled demolition, it seems like so much could go spin out of control, or there's the potential for that to spin out of control. And there's that element of, on the one hand, wanting to get rid of Assad in relation to everything you're talking about. At the same time, there's the question of you can't just throw things open. And you mentioned that they were arming some of these militias. And in one of the articles you wrote, you talked about that there's approximately 1,000 militias operating, and there's all kinds of forces in there. This, too, is full of contradictions for U.S. imperialism, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, let's look at the actual reason. You know, the June 13th announcements you mentioned for the U.S. that began direct military aid was justified by the fact that by the claim by the United States that it had found conclusive proof of chemical weapons used by the Assad regime. But there isn't any conclusive proof of chemical weapons. Nothing has been produced. International experts have said there has not been evidence of sarin gas use, which is being claimed, that has been produced. And actually, when these claims began to be raised in May, some UN agencies found equally or perhaps more compelling evidence that the opposition forces had either staged or used chemical weapons. And of course, let's not forget, in Iraq, we not only saw weapons of mass destruction being the main lie that was used to justify that war, we also know that it was the so-called Iraqi opposition which helped facilitate that lie. And by the way, even, look, 93,000 people have been killed in this war. And then Obama claims that the death of 150 people, which would be horrific if they were killed by chemical weapons, claims that's the reason for intervening. So again, it's very clear it has nothing to do with humanitarianism. But here's the deeper point. Even if the Assad regime had used chemical weapons, which they do possess, that's not why the U.S. is going into Syria. The U.S. is going into Syria at this moment in this way because the rebel forces have been suffering defeats. Partly because they're very scattered and disparate and so on and so forth. Partly because Hezbollah, a Lebanese Shiite political party with an army and armed forces under its command, intervened in the fighting in Syria. There's a town in western Syria, Qusair, in which there was heavy fighting, and the rebels were defeated. Now there's a big battle for Aleppo going on. Aleppo, the second largest city. And by the way, Michael, I just have to mention, I was in Damascus in 1980 on my way to Iran, and it's just a beautiful, very, very old city. This is the cradle of civilization we're talking about here, and it breaks my heart to see this history that is a prize for all humanity just being savaged by all of this. But anyway, it was this turn in the fighting that is what prompted the U.S. to intervene and try to bolster the rebels. It looks at this point, at least this is what's being reported, is that the U.S. may well be trying to bolster the rebels in advance of a peace conference. And this was just debated at the G8 summit that happened earlier this week in Northern Ireland. In advance of a peace conference, so-called Geneva Peace Conference on Syria, and the U.S. would be hoping that it could engineer the political departure of Assad without a full-scale war. And actually, at the G8, the U.S. and the other, its imperialist allies, made clear that they wanted to preserve the Syrian army and the Syrian state. In other words, they did not want a repeat of Iraq, where the army and the state were just dismantled, and then you had a civil war jump off in a very horrific kind of a way. But look, it is so. You know, there's a lot of maneuvering going on. I've heard analyses that the U.S. is actually sending in this level of arms, which is very unlikely to do much of anything on the battlefield, in order to bleed Iran and Hezbollah by forcing them to commit forces into this. This was something the U.S. imperialists are masters of. They've done in the region before, for example, the Iran-Iraq War of 1980-1988. So it's unclear exactly what the U.S. end game or the next step is, but the point you're making is very important. This is all very highly unpredictable and fraught with a lot of contradictions. Because one thing we have to understand, Syria really sits at the crossroads of the state. It's right in the middle of the entire state structure in the Middle East. It borders Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq. And, you know, this is a very fragile and volatile structure for reasons that we don't have time to get into today, but date back to how the imperialists, the British and the French, drew the borders after World War I, which was an imperialist war fought to control this region as well as Europe and the rest of the world. And the British and French secretly drew these borders for their interests, not the interests of the people of the region. This was exposed by Lenin after the Russian Revolution.
You have about 30 seconds, Larry.
This is a very fragile state structure here.
All right, Larry Everest.
The unpredictable part of it.
Okay. Larry Everest, thank you very much, and we'll have you back again soon. And boy, I'll tell you what, people want to go and check this all out. You can go to revcom.us and read Larry's article, U.S. Military Escalation in Syria, Yet More Horrors in Store for the Syrian People.
And I hope people get out in the streets about this. We've got to stop any U.S. escalation at all.
Absolutely.
It's unjust and no people.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, if ever there was a time for people to deeply grasp the meaning of internationalism, this is it. And if ever there was a time for people to think about getting up off their ass and doing something, this is actually one of those times. All right, Larry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
All right, take care. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Larry Everest. Larry is a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and he's the author of U.S. Military Escalation in Syria, Yet More Horrors in Store for the Syrian People. You can find it on revcom.us. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with J.C. Montgomery from the musical play The Scottsboro Boys, so stay tuned.
I made this song about Scottsboro Boys because I've been all over Alabama, Birmingham, Montgomery. And in Alabama, must be Jim Crow or something like that, because they turned loose something and they're trying to keep the others down. I don't see why don't you turn all of them loose. And this is a song with Scottsboro Boys. Go to Alabama and you better watch out. The landlord thinks you're gonna jump and shout. Scottsboro Boys, they can tell what it's all about. Booty Alabama, and you better watch out. The landlord gets you gonna jump and shout. That's what gospel boys, they can tell what it's all about. I'm gonna talk to a jeweler as handle his agent me. Don't he never try to make nobody in Alabama read. Booty Alabama, and you better watch out. The landlord gets you gonna jump and shout. That's what gospel boys, they can tell what it's all about. Booty Alabama, any better watch out. The landlord gets you gonna jump and shout. That's what gospel boys here is all about. I'm gonna tell all the colored people.
All right, that was Lead Belly with his song about the Scottsboro Boys. That's right, he's singing about the Scottsboro Boys, and that's what the next segment of our show is about. It's about a play that people have heard me talk about as being one of the most powerful plays I've seen in a very long time. It's the Scottsboro Boys. And joining us to talk about that is J.C. Montgomery. And J.C. plays one of the characters in the show that I think is really, really important, incredible job, and also sort of sets a very controversial tone to the whole show. Mm-hmm. And J.C. plays Mr. Tambo, and he was part of the original Broadway production of the Scottsboro Boys. He's also appeared on Broadway in a number of shows, including The Color Purple, and he's got extensive TV credits. And he's sitting here across me to talk about the Scottsboro Boys, which I have to tell you, J.C., it's like it was just one of the most, really the most amazing plays. Sitting there and not really, you know, I knew the story and I kept thinking, okay, how are they going to present this differently? What's the impact going to be? And it just knocked me back into my seat. It was really, really an incredibly powerful thing. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Why don't you tell people the story? I mean, I can you know, point out the sort of the initial thing of the story, the initial point about the trial, which, you know, the basically nine people that were 1931, mm-hmm. nine young black men who were hauled off of a train accused of raping two white women and spent, like, you know, a whole lot of time going through a whole lot of trials
right.
with no evidence, lying witnesses, all this other stuff, and just were just railroaded in the classic sense of railroad and spent a lot of their lives in jail, yeah. including one, Haywood Patterson, who died in jail.
Yeah. After 22 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes place in Scottsboro, Alabama, 1931. These boys were on a train, and the funny thing was they weren't all on the same section of the train. But that didn't matter because, like you said, they were railroaded through this trial. And they were pulled off the train because there was some fighting between some white boys. And they were accused of fighting, and then they found these two girls on the train. And they were going to throw them in jail also for prostitution. And so to keep themselves out of jail, the two girls said to the police officers, well, we were raped by these nine black boys. And so that just changed everything right there. The girls were taken in. They were giving, you know, they were checked out by doctors, even though the doctor said, well, you know, they weren't really raped. There is semen, but it's old. You know, they were supposedly raped on a bed of gravel. There are no marks on their backs if they were supposedly raped repeatedly by nine boys. So, and then they just ignored the doctor, said, no, these boys did it. Take them to jail. You know, we're going to hang them, you know. And then the sheriff who was actually there said, no, we can't hang them. It's not right. We should at least have a trial. And that's the only reason they weren't hanged right away, because of the one sheriff in the town. And it is so frightening to know that, you know, you're, what are their ages, 13 to 18 or 19, thrown in jail for a crime you didn't commit. You didn't know the other boys. I think maybe two of the boys knew each other, but that was it. And you're all accused of the same crime, even though you were on different parts of the train. And that's what Samuel Leibovitz tried to prove. You know, he brought in a whole train set, said, look, there were two boys here.
Samuel Leibovitz being?
The lawyer,
right. Mm-hmm.
From New York, who was brought down mm-hmm. to defend them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he brought in, you know, as part of his defense for the boys, he had a model of the exact train, you know, and he had the boys positioned on each spot where they were on the train. So these two boys were here, these two boys were like five cars down there, there was a boy here, and there's a boy there. There's no way they could have raped these girls. And it was so bad that there was a farmer who saw the train pass as he was in his field and said, yeah, I saw those boys from a distance of maybe half a mile. That's ridiculous. And they took that as evidence to convict these nine boys of a crime they didn't commit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, shocking.
Yeah.
And not just for, and seriously, it's, you know, not just for the South, but actually, you know, something we'll talk about towards the end of this interview is that there's a lot of playover to what's going on today mm-hmm. and how you end up in a country with 2.4 million people in jail mm-hmm. and most of them being black or Latino.
You yeah.
know, this is very, it's a very heavy, and a lot of them being in there. Geez, you know, for things they didn't do. You
right.
know, it's a very heavy scene. So let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with J.C. Montgomery, who plays Mr. Tambo and a variety of other characters in just one of the greatest plays I've seen in a long time, The Scottsboro Boys. I wanted to talk about this, though. Let's explain to people, too, that, you know, you play a number of characters in this film. I want to know what drew you to the play. And then you play a number of different characters in this play.
Right.
Which I admired you.
Thank you.
I was like, wait a minute, what's he doing?
I know, right? But, all over the place.
Yeah.
When I first was asked to do this production by Susan Stroman, who is the director and choreographer of the piece, she came to me and says, I'm doing this new piece. It involves in playing a lot of different characters. Are you interested? And this was for the table reading, which was years ago, at least maybe 4 years ago. And I said, yes, you know, it was a challenge. She says, and the thing is, you're going to play a lot of different white characters, which as an actor, being a black actor, you never play. You know, so it was a chance to do something that I never had the opportunity to do. So it was exciting, and to create these characters, the different voices. Now, I grew up in Kentucky, so Southern people weren't so hard for me to create because I grew up around the farmers and, you know, the Southern boys, the good old boys. So I just pulled a lot from that. And so I start off playing a sheriff, one of the sheriffs who arrests the boys for the crime they didn't commit. I go to playing a drunk real estate person who was actually brought in to defend the boys in their first trial. He wasn't even a lawyer. He was a real estate agent who was drunk all the time. And that's the way I play him on stage. Then I go from that to playing the prison guard, who's very racist and mean toward the boys. And then I have a chance to play a character, Samuel Leibowitz, who's from the North. He's a Northern lawyer who had won 77 cases in a row, hadn't lost one. And he did this case for free. He took it on for free. No one paid him. And he wanted to take it on because he knew the boys was in his heart. He knew the boys were innocent. He saw some of the evidence. And once he started digging even more, he said, this case is a joke. I'm going to win this. I'm going to go down here. I'm going to go down south. I'm going to win this case, set these boys free. But he got down there. They hated him just as much as they hated the boys. I mean, he had to hire bodyguards. The one defense they used against him was that he brought all of his Jew money down south and changed Ruby Bates' mind about the rape. And that's the only reason she changed her story. And that's not true. She changed her story because she couldn't live with herself and because she knew it was a lie and she didn't want to go on with it any further. But so he came down there, and it's great to play him. He has a great song. He has a great scene. And he really did everything he could to try to defend these boys. But he got to the point where they actually had to take him off the case because he was causing more trouble just by being there. And they hired another lawyer at the very end to get some of the boys off. I mean, we don't say that in our piece, but in the real world, that's actually what happened.
Well, tell me this about the play overall, because it's, you know, you're describing all the characters, and the main character that you end up playing is Mr. Tambo in terms of the centrality to the play.
Right.
And the fact that people should know that this is the thing that's actually both very controversial, I think, but also is very effective and very powerful, is this is done not only as a musical, but as a minstrel show, which is, to me, is like, you know, it was stunning. It was stunning to see that. And even though I had read stuff about it, I still wasn't prepared for that.
Right.
So can you talk about that a little?
Right. I think they were trying to figure out a way. Susan Stroman, John Kander, and Tommy Thompson were trying to figure out a way how to do this show without it costing a fortune. Because if you did it in the traditional sense of a Broadway show, you'd have a cast of maybe 20 or 30 people, which is very expensive to do a show nowadays because it costs so much money. But the main reason I think they chose this format is because the trials of the nine boys were referred to as the minstrel trials. And they thought, what a great idea. We can use actual dialogue, I mean, an actual statement to set up a format to tell this story.
And every time you boys get another trial, the verdict is the same. Trial number three, guilty. Trial number four, guilty.
But now how do we do that? Because normally a minstrel show is played with white people playing black people. So they wanted to show the injustice of the nine boys and the injustice of the racist format of the minstrel show. So they flipped it on its head. They had black people play all the white people. The set is all just a little bit off center. You know, everything is tilted. And it's just tell two different stories. There's injustice toward the boys, and this format is a racist format, and it's wrong. And that's why we chose that. That's why they chose that.
Yeah, it's incredible, actually, because I was reading something. I was reading a discussion somewhere of, who is it, John Kandar?
Mm-hmm.
And who wrote the play, and he was talking about that one of the
Tommy Thompson, who wrote the play?
Tommy Thompson, okay, yeah. No, but John Kander did.
Wrote the music.
Wrote the music, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about this thing about the minstrel show, the minstrel aspect of it. And there was somewhere, I can't remember who said it, but they were commenting on how it looked like it was actually, there was people were struggling with how do you take a story that in some ways has been told a lot of times, although the horror of living in America today is that no matter how many times it's told, it's rarely remembered,
right.
You know, and the fact that this kind of thing can go on and time again today and reflect and be really linked to this, and nobody even thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the point about how do you make this story as sharp and edgy as possible? And I've talked to a lot of people who said I was really uncomfortable, you know, and I said it seems to be exactly the point.
Yes, yeah, you're supposed to be uncomfortable, and if theater works, sometimes it's supposed to affect you in some way. So that's the way we've – but, you know, we get you in so many different ways. We make you laugh, and you go, wait a minute. Well, okay, I don't want to laugh now because now something serious is happening. And then we make you want to weep. I mean, you know, because when four of those boys – near the end, four boys get out, and the rest have to stay. And the defense is the South says that, well, these four younger boys aren't guilty of rape, so they've stayed in jail long enough. Well, that's ridiculous because the evidence for all of the boys was the same. So if you're going to release those four, you should release all of them. So, yeah, so we get you in so many different ways. But, you know, for theater to work, I think, it has to have an effect on you. You have to feel something. And this is a great piece because at the end you want to talk about it, you want to discuss it, and that's what theater is about, right?
Well, there's also the point, too, that, how, you know, this case was such a horror, and how could you tell it in any more powerful way than in a form that's just as much of a horror in terms of the dehumanization of black people?
Exactly, yeah. And that's a great way to do it. And it takes a lot of courage to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fine line you have to walk because you can't go too far with it. But then if you don't commit to it, then it doesn't work. So you have to walk a fine line of making it work. And I think Susan Stroman and Tommy and Kander did a great job with that.
Yeah, and the other thing it really does too is it really does put you in that time in a certain sense because it does make you – you're looking at this. It's like – it's you're shocked. You're like sitting – you're looking at this piece of theater and you're thinking – one, this is really, and you know, look, I went to see a show about maybe a year or a year and a half ago or something. Mm-hmm. It was at another theater in the city, and it was based on minstrelsy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with a black friend who got up and said, I can't sit through this anymore, you know, and had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I sat there, and I said, well, I'm going to watch a little bit longer. And I sat there, and really, I have never, ever in my life left the play before seeing the second act, no matter how much I didn't like it.
Right.
But this was so despicable.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing that could, you know, you were just, I felt like puking in the theater. And it was just, I was like, there's nothing, you're just slapping around here.
Yeah.
This play, very different because you're as shocked as you should be, as they should have been at the time. You're really shocked by this. And I think that that point is very important in terms of putting you in there, you know, really putting you in there because it's such a universal story, as we've been saying. It's such a universal story.
Yeah.
Beyond the particularity of the time and the place there.
Yeah.
So I think it's really was a remarkable device.
Yeah, it is. And like you said, this story is universal, and it's always going to be relevant as long as there is injustice in this world. And that we keep making the same mistakes over and over. So, of course, this piece will always work. But you're right, yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with J.C. Montgomery, who plays Mr. Tambo and a variety of other characters in just one of the greatest plays I've seen in a long time, The Scottsboro Boys. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, J.C., is that, you know, this point of, again, there's such a, this play seems to be built on cognitive dissonance. You know, it's sort of like, for instance, you're sitting there and you're moving to the music and you're enjoying the music. And then you're looking up and you're like, wait a minute, what am I doing? And then you're listening to the songs. Songs that you're liking that are about the electric chair, you know, is like, whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, how I used to love that song. I remember sitting on my porch, hearing it at twilight, rising up from the cotton fields. Oh, and you boys sing that song so beautifully, just the way I love it. Wouldn't hurt if you smiled a bit.
And in the kitchen, Mammy's pulling pork, cooking grits, scrubbing hair. How the sights and sounds come back.
part of the song.
How hard was that to do?
How do I say this? You know, the melodies of the songs are great because you want to hum them, you want to sing along. But then you listen to the lyrics and you go, wait a minute, I can't sing that song. You know, I can't sing a song about frying someone in the electric chair or Jew money or, you know, things like that. Or Southern Days where it says, don't you remember my daddy hanging from a tree? They're like, wait, this is a beautiful song, but wait a minute, the lyric. But that's what's amazing about the show. It's once again, I'm talking about we walk that fine line. We take you a little bit that way, a little bit this way, but we stay. If you go too far, you're going to get up and leave. And we've had people to get up and leave. We've had people to protest the show. In New York, we had people protesting the fact that it was a minstrel format. You know, they were invited to come in and see the show, and we wanted to have a conversation with them, but they didn't want to come in. And so they protested the whole time we were there. They protested when we went to the Tonys. And then the funny thing is, we did the show in Philadelphia. Some of the same people who were protesting the show decided to come see it. They were in tears, and they apologized. They said, we didn't realize that you were telling a story that was saying that the trials were wrong, the minstrel format is wrong, but we just heard minstrel setup, you know, minstrel format, and we were like, no, we're not going to see that. You shouldn't be doing that. But we're using it to make the story even stronger. So,
well, you know, and that's an important point. I mean, look, again, I keep coming back to this because there's such a – we're so inured to the kind of – the stuff that hits us every day about – and all the stereotypes and everything else. And, you know, look, who knows who's telling the truth, what's going on. Come on, this is just another story. Right. Or everything comes down the pike. I mean, I look at even Trayvon Martin, you know.
Yeah.
And Trayvon Martin is killed.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this, and we see all the injustice that gets concentrated up in what's happening around that case and around him, mm-hmm. and including from the moment that he's killed, and they have the killer standing next to him, and the cops come up and they do a blood test for drugs on Trayvon's body, and then they do a search for his criminal record.
Mm-hmm.
You know why? Because he was a black youth with a hoodie on.
Yeah.
You know, and this is carrying an Arizona iced tea.
I know. You know, coming from a 7-Eleven.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Exactly. But the thing is that's the story that gets told and retold. And the problem is people forget. They forget, not only forget, but they become insensitive and inured to this. They become sort of, you get this hard leather skin over you, mm-hmm. and you just go past. And that's the point about the minstrel show. That I thought it was brilliant because it forces you to deal with the truth of this, with the minstrelsy is a dehumanizing art form.
Yes.
It's being used to bring out the humanity mm-hmm. of the Scottsboro Boys and beyond that, the humanity of black people as a whole mm-hmm. throughout history.
Right.
That is something that's been a major point of contention,
right.
You know, and continues to be to this day. And so I thought that was just a remarkable way of doing it. And I thought one of the ways when you guys did it, there's a scene, I think it was one, maybe the first cakewalk you had.
Right.
And there's a scene where I could see the different characters, the different Scottsboro Boys as they would dance up, and you could see the seething.
Right.
You know, there'd be the kind of minstrel face, you know, mm-hmm. the hands and the face and the smiles and the
right.
big, you know, bug eyes and all that stuff. But then there would be, every now and then you'd see a glance that was just so full of seething.
Right.
And just, you know, this is just terrible. And it just drilled right into me.
Right. And you see a lot of that at the very end
mm-hmm.
when they don't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They stand up against it. And that's when it gets really powerful, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was incredible. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with J.C. Montgomery, who plays Mr. Tambo and a variety of other characters in just one of the greatest plays I've seen in a long time, The Scottsboro Boys. What about the point where the Haywood Patterson character says, okay, we're going to do this, and he's talking to Mr. Tambo and Mr. Bones.
And the interlocutor.
Mm-hmm. Hal Linden, who does a remarkable job.
He's amazing,
as well. Yeah. And he says, this time we're going to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little.
Well, that's a part of the show. We start off with this big song and dance number. It's all happy. And you're the lyrics, and we have funny jokes, and everybody's like, oh, this is going to be a great show. Ah, wow, that's so funny. And then he steps up. He goes, this time when we tell the story, can we tell the truth? And the interlocutor goes, well, sure, Haywood. And then we start to tell the truth of the story, of how it really happened, of how these girls lied, of how these poor innocent boys who were looking for work, and the majority of them were looking for work because it was during the Depression, and they were just trying to find a job, and then they were thrown into jail.
Haywood Patterson to the stand. Lawyer Bones.
What were you doing on that train?
I was hungry. Tired of waiting for handouts.
My daddy told me to leave. Can't afford to have you around here. We was gonna make some money for my mom.
I told my sis, don't worry. We was gonna get work on the river.
There's something to do, ain't it?
I was gonna be back before anyone figured I was gone.
I was working on a sawmill. They treated me so bad I couldn't stay there.
I was headed home. I almost made it too.
I was looking for work.
And so their dreams, all their hopes were gone, you know. The majority of their, you know, young years were gone. Haywood spent 22 years in jail and died there, you know. And the only reason they wanted to let him out was if he lied and said, yes, I did it, just so he could get paroled. And that's ridiculous. I mean, what a way to get out of prison.
Go on. Take my shoes. Shirt off my back. Strip me naked. Take my name. Make me an animal so you can kill me and forget all about me. Like I never happened. Like I don't matter. But I didn't do this. I am not taking the blame. I'm gonna get out of here. I got to get out of here. I ain't dying for a lie.
You've been telling the truth the whole time, but yet if you lie, they're gonna let you out. What does that tell about the judicial system, you know? It's a bad statement.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I also wanted to get into, well, let me ask you this. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with about the play?
Well, for me, it's different than the boys. The boys have to endure the punishment, the lines that are being said to them. I'm the one saying the lines. And so there are times I'm on stage going, I can't believe I'm saying this. I can't believe I'm doing this, you know, to one of my people, you know. But if I don't do that, the story doesn't work. So I think that's the hardest thing for me, is to actually be up there, to say some of those lines, to be that lawyer who's drunk, who doesn't really know how to defend the boys, you know. It's a little bit disturbing when you know, and I know the story, and I know that they were innocent, and I know that they were being railroaded. So it's, but if I don't act that way, the piece doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with J.C. Montgomery, who plays Mr. Tambo and a variety of other characters in just one of the greatest plays I've seen in a long time, The Scottsboro Boys. Let's talk about, again, we've been keep coming back to this, but I wanted to, there's a couple of things I wanted to get into, because there's a couple of times that you're struck with the relevance of this too today. You know, how did you look at that in terms of doing that? I mean, did you guys actually talk about this? Because it seems like one thing is, it seems like in a play like that, you've got to have an immense amount of collectivity, is one way of putting it, but collaboration and actually people having each other's back and really, yeah. you know, how you deal with this, because it's such an emotional thing, right. And it's such a powerful thing, and it's such a, you know, controversial thing.
Right. To answer those questions, I wanted to do this piece because it's important to do this piece, to get the story out, to tell the story, so that we can stop making the same mistakes over and over again as a people, you know, not just black or white, but just as, you know, humanity, to stop making the same mistakes over and over again. Now, how do we deal with it? Well, before the show, we all circle up. And if someone has anything to say, we talk about it. Sometimes we say a few words. At the end of the show, we always check in with one another. Because we never leave it with just, you know, because some things are being said, you know, the boys are wearing, I don't want to say give all mm-hmm, of it away, mm-hmm. But, you know, but we all check in with one another just to make sure everybody's okay. Even throughout the day, if someone sends a text, hey, how you feeling? You okay? Yeah, I'm good. You know, because for some people who are new to this, see, I've been doing it a long time. I've done maybe 6 productions of this. Some people are doing it for the first time. And for the people who first come in, it's very emotional for them, you know, and it's very hard because it's a lot to deal with. It's a lot to go through as a black person to relive, you know, some of the things that happened in our past, you know. And we also do it to honor the 9 boys. Someone has to keep their story out there, you know, because it was a tragedy. And if you're reminded of that, hopefully we won't do that again.
Now, I know New York, it had a really good run and when it first came out, and then in Broadway, when it went on Broadway, it had a very short run.
Yeah, we were surprised at that.
Look, this play is not without its detractors, okay? They can try and kill it by kindness in a certain sense, but they also can do things like you were saying, the demonstrations, things like this. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about that because, you know, here it seems like there's a certain amount of, well, there's a certain amount of, you know, popularity attached to mm-hmm. this thing. People are coming and getting into it and all this stuff.
Right.
San Diego was a little controversial, as I understand.
Yeah. But it and, did well in San
yeah,
Diego.
Good,
yeah,
good, good, good. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, there's this point that was made. Now, it's, again, from John Kander's letter mm-hmm. about his impetus for creating the Scottsboro
Boys as a musical. And he said he wanted to know, but he said the question that kept constantly being posed in his own head was, how was it possible that a group of innocent boys could be destroyed by a single lie? Why was it easier to believe that lie than it was to accept the truth? That's a pretty heavy statement.
Yeah, it's very heavy, yeah. Well, that's a product of the time, too. It was 1931. You're definitely going to believe two white girls over nine black boys. You know, it's the South. It's Alabama, deep South. Two white girls come up and say, hey, this boy looked at me the wrong way. You're in trouble. You know, he made eye contact with me. He was looking at my, you know, my bottom, my rear end, you know. Any of those things, if a white girl said that, you were most of the time not even taken, you know, had the opportunity to have a trial. You were just hung from a tree, you know, because they were hung for less, you know. So it's just a product of the time, I think.
Although it's also interesting, too, because when the one young white woman wants to recant her testimony and say, look, I was lying through my teeth for whatever reason, I was lying.
Yeah.
Then nobody wants to pay attention to the young
white
woman.
By that time, the momentum had taken over.
Well, the momentum had taken over. But also, you know, it was one of these things where, you know what, if you're not going along with the program, sorry.
It's
not
exactly
gonna happen,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you think about the context of what was happening at that time. Look, you know, as I'm about to say this, I'm thinking, okay, is it all that different now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lynchings, the Klan, you know, and these all take different forms today, you know, where the same kinds of things are put out. And I was thinking about this in New York, the stop and frisk campaigns there and what's happening to people there. And the fact that, you know, just a little while ago, the 5 millionth person was stopped by stop and frisk. 5 million people. Now, that means the entire population of Manhattan would have been stopped three times, you know, for over a period of about 5 years or 6 years. And you think about this. This is the similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think about this relevance again. How can all these people's lives be destroyed by one lie?
I know.
You know, and that's that is a question that continues to be posed very heavily today.
Yeah.
Well, I usually ask people, but I don't know. You know, people aren't prepared for it, so then that's fine. But can you do anything from the play to just give people a sense of it? You don't have to.
Yeah, I could do a little bit. I could sing a little bit of the song. It starts, it's kind of speak singing at the beginning, and then he goes into a song. He goes, I was passing by two water fountains Saturday night. One was marked for colored only and the other for white. Well, I know that that's the custom here in Alabama, but that's not the way we do things in New York. So that's kind
of All right.
She's basically saying, look, you guys do things a certain way down here. We do it differently up north. We're going to change all that. I think that was part of his problem. He got in trouble there.
All right. Thank you very much. And that was J.C. Montgomery doing the part of the lawyer Samuel Leibowitz.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure, man. It was really a pleasure seeing you in the play and seeing the whole play. And I just want to remind people once again that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking today with J.C. Montgomery, who plays Mr. Tambo, and a number of other characters, the lawyer Samuel Leibowitz and quite a few others. Mm-hmm. And he plays them in the play The Scottsboro Boys. And boy, don't anybody ever try to tell me that there isn't a component of genocide in the treatment of black people here in this country, all right? That's just a settled question. And when you think about the Scottsboro Boys, think about what's going on today. The police brutality and terror, the murder at the hands of the police. You think about, you know, the whole question of mass incarceration, 2.4 million people, at least half of them black and Latino people. Think about that. Think of a modern day comparison to the Scottsboro Boys, okay? The Central Park Five, those five young men, black and Latino, who were falsely accused of raping a young white woman jogging through Central Park back in the 90s. And what happened? They were eventually, after doing long terms in prison, they were found, they didn't do it. Somebody else confessed to it. So that's, you know, that's a lot to chew on. All right, well, that brings another show to a close. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my intern production assistant, Jeff Pryor. And I know because he's sitting back there saying, tell him about me, tell him about me. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, all right? And I want to thank all of you for tuning in, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But as I was thinking about today's program, there's something I think we really need to talk about, and that is the way that this society is hooked up, the way that this society functions, should leave all of us, especially not just because of what's going on today, because it's been going on for a long time, but especially when we see things like mass incarceration, like police terror, like all the racism and the discrimination that's going on out here, like the wars, and also like the NSA spying, that we've all become just acutely aware of the fact that
Every person in this country is being listened to and spied on by the government. That's right. The Obama regime is spying on you. Shh. They might hear us, okay? And think about that, and then think about the big question that should be raised in all of our heads is how long? How long do we have to put up with this? How long are we going to tolerate this? How long are we going to live under this? And that's a very pressing question, especially because it doesn't have to be this way, because there is another way that we all could be living. And the person I'm about to read a quote from is the person who's mapped out and figured out a way to get out from under this, all this oppression and suffering. And that's Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and his new Synthesis of Communism, which everybody should be checking out. Whether you agree with it or not agree with it, you need to check it out so you can at least talk about it, all right? And think about it. And think about it as we live in this world that's just spinning to hell right now, all right? So let me read you something from Avakian, which I think is very appropriate for our program today and for what's coming up in the coming months. No more generations of our youth here and all around the world whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion even before they are born. I say no more of that. And that's from Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's taken from his book, Basics, and it's Basics, Chapter 1, Quote 13. All right, now that really does bring us to the close of the show. If you want to follow me, you can on Facebook and or Twitter. Just be quiet because I might be asleep and you don't want to wake me up. You don't know what will happen if you start stomping your feet and you wake me out of a sound sleep, all right? But you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to join in a conversation, you want to leave opinions, you want to just like rattle some things around, you can do that at michaelslate.wordpress.com. That's my blog. That's what they tell me, okay? michaelslate.wordpress.com. All right, so you can do all that. And if you want to just write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, and now one last thing before we finally go out for this week's show. I want you to think about all those folks down in Guantanamo who are going on a hunger strike. I want you to think about all the California prisoners who are about to go on a hunger strike. And I want you to think about all those sisters and brothers in Brazil and Turkey and how they're throwing down and hitting hard. Think about that, and then think about this. Street Fighting Man from the Rolling Stones.